Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it, it's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line, now 20% lower. Family plans, also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone, all with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, gotta let it go. So far, so free, go. Stars tonight.
Open the voice gate for June 10th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find Open the Voice Gate on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on the dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast, and you set up a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, just wanted to do a little bit of a mental health check as we are in this NBA Finals season. A big come-from-behind win in Game 1, not really breaking that way in Game 2. How is the heart of Pacer Nation going right now?
It's good. We're in the NBA Finals. Are you kidding me? All right, you know, look, it's going to be great to win a title if we do, but if not, we lost to the Thunder, who I think are a historically great team, and by the general consensus, the mainstream population, I think, are still terribly underrated despite winning 68 games in the regular season and having the playoff run that they've had. It's great. We won Game 1 of the Finals. There's nothing else I want. This is fantastic. I would love, you know, as we're recording this Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Game 3 in Indy, and then Game 4 Friday night in Indy. If we win one of those, oh my God, that'd be fantastic.
Make it into a best of three, essentially.
It's, you know, tomorrow night, I assume they're going to have a bunch of legends there. You know, one of the Knicks games, they had Jermaine O'Neal in the house, and they had Danny Granger, and it was kind of notable because Danny Granger doesn't ever go to things. Not that he's on bad terms with the team, but once he retired, he just sort of disappeared, and it was like a big deal in Indy that it was like, oh my God, Granger is going to be there. And I think everybody is kind of waiting, even though as a coach, he inherited a Larry Brown team and then took that team to the finals. And as a GM, he was an absolute disaster and set the Pacers back many, many years with many of his bad white European draft picks. But the buzz is, hey, is Larry Bird going to be there? Because that would be a nice little get for the Pacers if Larry Bird showed up for game 3 or 4. So that's what we've got going on. But no, oh my God, I mean, to be a Pacers fan, to be in the finals, I had no complaints whatsoever.
Yeah, I have to say, like, being able to kind of heal that wound with, like, Larry Bird and having that opportunity, like, I felt like there was a little bit of that in its own way with, like, Juan Gonzalez coming back into the fold right in the lead up of the Rangers World Series. And it was just something where, and even, like, Nefertiti Feliz is someone that gets, I think, wrongly lambasted for what the Rangers did in 2010. But it is, like, situationally something where I'm kind of more, like, intellectually, like, going, like, oh, you know, Juan Gonzalez was kind of left the team on bad circumstances, had nothing good to say, never showed up to, like, his Rangers Hall of Fame induction, which, there is one of those. And basically the names you think would be in there are basically all that Hall of Fame. But I find that at least, even if it's just being able to have that moment where it's like Larry Bird in front of Pacer fans and not calling for his head and, like, moving on, like, generationally, that is just, like, at the very least, that seems like that would be a notable healing kind of thing for that fan base.
I think Larry can kick rocks. I hold him in no esteem, and the Pacers immediately got better as an organization when he stepped down. But I know a lot of people would be excited. It'd be a nice get for Indy. So that's what we've got going on there. I hold him in no affinity, though. The thing that I want to talk about with you, but we've obviously got a million Drangate things to talk about. I don't get the impression that you've been online much today, so maybe you don't know what I'm talking about when I say this, but obviously, elephant in the room, we have to have the conversation, Mike, that we've learned today that Eddie Guerrero was actually bad and was a bad luchador. Your thoughts on this revelation that we've all as a collective made today?
Man, I no longer have the Everything app on my phone, and it is just one of those things that, like, if you've noticed, like, I've been, like, trying to do less and less of it. So I completely missed this. Was this something where, like, is this about, like, the him and Bart Starr, like they were showing, like, their clips and that got and the woke won't like it case?
No, although that could happen any day. My favorite brand of tweet is when Rover points out that Eddie Guerrero would have been a super conservative Republican if he were alive, which always just makes me laugh. But no, let me get to the bottom of this. Okay, so somebody called Rey Mysterio the greatest luchador of all time, and I don't know where that thread began. I don't know what that was, but there was Rey Mysterio discourse, and then Dave chimed in. There was a tweet that said, this is not from Dave, this is from Ori Gautre. I hate the internet. That person said, Rey Mysterio is maybe the single most influential wrestler of the last 35 years, but that's not the same thing as being the greatest luchador of all time. Dave quote tweeted that and said, El Santo is the biggest luchador star. Greatest in-ring luchador is very difficult to say. Somebody said, I had this argument about El Santo last week. And then Dave quote tweeted that person and said, there's not an argument as far as the biggest star. There is a huge one about the best in ring. At old style, it could be Hamada or Eddie. As at today's style, it's much tougher. That led to Segun de Cade's Matt D checking in and quote tweeting Dave. For whatever reason, Matt D is extremely insecure. I don't know if jealous is the right word. Maybe envious is the right word. Whenever Dave talks about Lucha, something that Dave has covered for 40 years now, something that Dave writes about weekly and routinely says is the best style of wrestling in the entire world. Matt can't handle that for some reason. I don't know why. I like Matt well enough. You know, I respect what he does. I don't know why Matt can't handle Dave Meltzer having any sort of input on Lucha Libre, despite the fact that he's covered it better and closer than anybody else over the last 45 years. But yeah. Matt said in a quote tweet to that, he goes, the most generous way to explain this statement is that it's written like someone who hasn't actually taken the time to watch any 80s or 90s Lucha since we discovered and organized so much footage in the last 20 years, or since it actually happened live decades ago. So Matt is mad at Dave Meltzer for not taking time out of his busy schedule to sit down and watch 80s and 90s Monterey footage, which, as much as I would love it if Dave did that, that is not what Dave's job is.
Yeah. No, like, absolutely. Like, that is just kind of a, like, I think, like, Dave, like, started, like, his Lucha exposure when, like, Mascaris would come up and work Roy Shire in the 60s, too.
Yes.
So, like, since a child, essentially, has been around Lucha Libre.
And I responded to Matt. I said, you're a giant loser if you're complaining about somebody putting over Hamada, and this is coming as somebody that is constantly watching 80s and 90s Lucha footage. And Matt replied, which was the kicker in all this, is that he said Hamada's great. And if he would have said Hamada and Pero, I might not have said anything at all, implying that somehow Eddie Guerrero is the wrong answer to this question. And let me tell you, as somebody who has talked routinely on this podcast about watching all of 1993 AAA TV last year, Eddie Guerrero, good wrestler. I'll say it, good wrestler. So some would say, other than Santo in 1993 AAA, best wrestler in the promotion, maybe La Parca, but probably Eddie. And I love Pero, but boy, what a day that was.
Man, I'm still like wrapping my head around, especially given like what Eddie was doing like up through 95, thinking that he was like this giant slight in like your lucha knowledge, is thinking that like when he was one of the most popular acts in Gringos Locos, that it was bad.
But it wasn't Satanico, and it wasn't El Dandy. And so it's the wrong answer to that crowd, which is fine. It's fine. But it's just, we have to now, Eddie Guerrero bad. That is what we've learned from today. Mike, we have a bunch of Dragon Gate stuff to talk about. And per usual, unfortunately, I am going to rush out of here as quickly as I can. So let's run through this Dragon Gate stuff, because I've got a lot to say and not a lot of time to say it.
Yeah, so last week we did those days because of the Wednesday and Thursday shows in Corcoran Hall. Case did the written review for 6-4. I did the written review for 6-5, both on voicesofwrestling.com. But Case, I think like really before we get into the big blow-by-blow for 6-4 and 6-5, we had to talk about kind of the biggest news that came out of these two shows at Corcoran Hall, being the fact that we're now fully on the road to Kobe World Pro Wrestling Festival 2025, as the Dreamgate scenario has been made clear. If you're wanting this to kind of be spoiler free, you might want to fast forward for the next like few minutes. But we have our main event for Kobe World this year, and it is Yamato defending the Open the Dreamgate title, hopefully making his ninth defense against the one person who has solidly had his number all year, dating back to January, Shun Skywalker. And Shun Skywalker, so confident about his victory on July 13th, has stated if he does not win the Dreamgate at Kobe World, he's leaving Dragon Gate.
My initial reaction to this, maybe panic is the wrong word, but my initial reaction to this was to gulp a little bit and to try to put myself in this reality that while they set up a match between Shun and Yamato, the first Corkin show of the year, and we had a lot of different conversations as time has gone on about, well, maybe it's going to be Kakuta, maybe it's going to be this guy, maybe it'll be Shingo, maybe it'll be Despy. I think all those were fruitful conversations, but since January, we've been staring in the face of Shun versus Yamato at World, the first time they've done that match in 4 years. At World, Mike, off the top of my head, have they repeated a Kobe World main event before this one?
I mean, I think T-Hawk versus Yoshino, right? Like, they ran that one twice. I thought that was a double, a rerun there, but...
Okay, wait, hold on. So, they did that in 2015. They really did headline that twice. Holy shit,
yeah,
they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, because in 2015, they're like, this can't possibly go wrong again. Let's do take two of this. And it was, no, the exact same response, except even more so. So, like, that's the only other, like, real time. Because, I mean, like, the fascinating thing is with, like, Hulk and Shingo, they only main evented World 1 year. The hair match was not the main event in 2010. Although that is kind of the big match you remember from that year, at least in comparison to the main event. But, like... It does not necessarily happen that often, but like, you're absolutely right when you talk about a match looming, a match that we were trying to kid ourselves with any other ideas. Like, I thought we were bringing in Shingo Takagi here just because, like, who else could go up against Yamato at this point? But like, that was trying to fool reality, and the reality, at least from January, we knew it was kind of hanging over us, was the fact that Shun Skywalker obliterated Yamato. And when you look towards July, that should have been a very obvious kind of situation, and it just happens to so far kick off after an incredible Dreamgate match, Yamato making safe defense against Masaki Mochizuki. And it's just kind of like a wild thing that just, in a way, I think the entire staging this of, if I don't win, I'm going to leave. In a way, the more I've thought about it, the more I'm just kind of don't know if it's my head in the dirt or if it's like, oh, those are really good ways to make this match like to feel like that this match isn't like an outright coronation of Shun Skywalker, you know, because
I disagree with that. I'm not into this stip. And I guess part of that, I was getting there, a roundabout way of saying, you know, I do think we have to perhaps wrap our heads around the fact that I think it's 80-20. Yamato wins. I don't really feel comfortable putting the odds any greater than that. I think because of some things that are going on in the Japanese landscape right now, and I could talk about those in just a second, I think we have to at least wrap our heads around the idea of Shun possibly leaving. If Shun wins, I think it's a huge mistake they did this step. I don't like this in wrestling. This is not something that is ever, just because it's never true in wrestling, you know, stipulations are broken all the time. I don't like this. And if Shun wins, I think it's going to be a real missed opportunity that they dangled this carrot over our head that ultimately didn't pay off. Like, I'm almost at the point now, obviously I don't want a Dragon Gate without Shun Skywalker, but given the stipulation that's at hand, I almost think they have to go through with it. I don't like the idea. I think if this match was just Yamato versus Shun for the belt, I think it'd be 50-50, and you could talk me into either scenario, just like it was in 2021. We're at a point now where it's like, well, I guess Shun has to win, or else things are going to get really weird, and that is sadly the more interesting of the options here.
Yeah, I guess like the one thing that we could take from that was it was Shun in the promo saying it, and when you've like looked at like let me see right now on the Gaora website if the for Kobe World, which does have their match card already listed, it is not listed as a stipulation on that.
I noticed that. I noticed in the English tweet as well. They did not note that. Also, I have to back up real quick. 2017 was Yamato versus T-Hawk.
Why did I think that was a Yoshino match?
I thought it was too. It was Yoshino T-Hawk in 2015, Shingo Yamato in 2016, Yamato T-Hawk in 2017, and Yoshino Shingo in 2018.
Yep. Yeah.
So this would be the first repeat world main event because Yamato versus Shun was the second night of, I guess, what is considered Speed Star Final. So not technically Kobe World, but it's the second time. It's the first time ever they've done a match twice headlining in the big Kobe venue.
Yeah. And you really kind of had that match on that show. And even though that was a really strong end to Shun Skywalker's first title run. The story of the show was all about Yoshino's retirement, even though it was 2 days in Kobe and in Kobe World Cannon Hall, and the way they kind of phrased it in a way that like leaves this kind of like it as like this little like dangling participle about it of was that Kobe World or not. I think at the time we were considering it two nights of Kobe World, so I would treat this as that rematch, you know?
Well, it's also a weird thing, and I forget what we were talking about. We were talking about Shun's legacy a few months ago, and I made the point that the worst thing to ever happen to him is that weekend he had the KZ match and the Yamato match, and if he just has one of those matches, I think it's universally agreed upon that that's the best Shun Skywalker match of his career, but he had 2 4-3-quarter-star matches in back-to-back days, and the audience split. It was like old school match of the year voting when G1 season came around, where like I prefer the KZ match, but I know a lot of people prefer the Yamato match. And it's almost like those matches were so good on back-to-back days that they no longer exist historically. And it's a clap crowd still. It's a very weird time in history. But I would say there's a lot of people that when that match was announced, they didn't immediately go, oh, that's a rematch from 2021.
Right. Yeah. Like with like the situation there and yeah, I think I am a KZ match more than a Yamato match person with it.
But they were both incredible.
Right. Yeah. Like it was like one was 4 3/4 and one was 4.5 in my mind. But like, and I think it was you can debate it to the end of the earth, which day Shun had the better match. But like it's such an interesting proposal they have with this.
So the reason I say it's got to be 80-20, and again, that's going under the assumption that they're going to play this stipulation through in the way that Shun Skywalker announced. And I'm glad you brought that up, that indeed that is something that was referenced in Shun's promo that hasn't been referenced in any official verbiage from the company. I'd be curious to see if we get an update on that this weekend, but let's just live in the reality of it. Either Shun wins the belt or he leaves Dragon Gate. The only reason that I even entertain the thought of Shun leaving Dragon Gate is not him going to New Japan. It's certainly not him going to All Japan. I don't think it's him going to Noah. We are in a situation in which we are currently recording, in which the future of Tetsuya Naito and Bushi is still very much up in the air. And I was talking to John Carroll today. I was going to say I was talking to somebody. I was talking to the only person that knows about Tetsuya Naito more than Tetsuya Naito. I said, John, what's going on with Naito? Remind me where he's at, what he's doing. And Naito and Bushi, they have two like speaking engagements, one in Tokyo that's already sold out, one in Fukuoka. And John wasn't sure if tickets were on sale for that one or not yet. The only reason that I would ever have any doubt that Shun Skywalker was leaving Dragon Gate is essentially if Naito was going to do SWS 2.0 and get a bunch of money and raid a bunch of wrestlers and shake up the ecosystem in a way that wouldn't seem sustainable nor wise given the lack of depth and talent in the current Japanese ecosystem.
Sure.
But it's the type of thing that if Tetsuya Naito gets money behind him and it's Tetsuya Naito, Bushi, and Shun Skywalker and gang, that's okay. You've got my attention. That's the only reason I have to entertain the thought of Shun possibly leaving Dragon Gate.
And I think that we do have to be kind of honest about the Dragon Gate money situation. It's not been great since 2010 or not 2010. I'm sorry, 2020. And it's like a point that I find like I talk with people with like in Discord or in other places is like their Dragon Gate essentially had to eat everything. That like there was no Cyber Agent, Bushiroad, basically like operating in like supplying a budget or anything like that. Dragon Gate just had to take it. And as we've like talked with like Jay about, like there's been like financial things that they have done over the years to kind of mitigate some of these pains. Some of that was contracts and some of that was production and some of that what we talk about, it feels like a lot. And some of the things we don't talk about nearly enough, but like with someone like Shun Skywalker and with like the realities around the company, like if there's a situation, even like if it's not even to a scale of an SWS case, like think about Eichmann and Uptown's doing really well with like their shows and like Shinjuku Face and such like that. And that was
my thought, was almost like a bulletin on steroids.
Right. Like that. And the reality is that like not very many people are drawing more than 1,200 people in Tokyo to something. And that's proving at least to some level to be kind of like a sustainable number to see. And if you're saying like, oh, Naito and Bushi, that they've done like the Tranquilos del Japón, like new branding, and they're going to have a date coming up at Corcoran Hall. Like I say that, like, dude, that's probably going to do about 1,200 by themselves. You add in Shun there, and that's very easily becomes a show that's going to make a good deal of money, you know? And I think that, like, I didn't think about the SWS idea until you put that thought in my head, really. And it does make me kind of raised out a little bit more. But, like, I wasn't even kind of considering that kind of situation, and I still said, like, I think it's pretty much like a coin flip scenario for me, and that's in light of Shun saying that, because realities are that like this is a promotion that has had to basically transform itself because of COVID, and there were a lot of real pains that weren't just absorbed in and later sussed out. There were pains that I feel like still exist. So that's a very roundabout way of me saying like I can buy into the stipulation if the company starts making it to a thing, basically.
And this is the only scenario in which I can entertain. I don't see the jump to New Japan. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, I think
they don't have the money either, really.
Yeah,
even with that backbone. Yeah.
You know, the template for him there would be Shingo, but I don't think they're looking for, in the same way that, you know, Shingo came in and joined LIJ and it made sense. I guess I'm not super up to date on New Japan storylines at this moment in time, but I don't think there's a scenario like that. All Japan wouldn't have the money, and Noah, I don't know, unless they're going under the table and saying, brother, you're going to beat Ozawa 1-2-3 and you're going to be the new guy, which is not something that would happen. It's the only thing I can entertain is Naito and Bushi are out there and they're going to do something. Now, I think it's more realistic that we get Bushi on a Dragon Gate show in an El Desperado type role. But
right, yeah.
It's the type of thing that we can't ignore.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the kind of thing that, like, I don't completely dismiss the stipulation, basically, or what Shun is saying. But it really, at least, you take the match on its face, and it does feel like that if we look at this just from a guy's from Yamato's perspective, like taking in this, like going from like our zoom out way into just Yamato, this is kind of like the one guy that's left on his plate and the one person that you go into the match with, because you go to the match with versus like Okuda, where you go like, all right, like this is someone that has like put the huge dent into the wall. Now this makes it kind of like an interesting scenario, like comparing that to like Madoka Kakuda, you know, like this does kind of make a more interesting main event for like Yamato's perspective, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, if the stipulation ends up not coming to fruition and it's just Yamato versus Shun for the belt, I think it's 100 times more interesting, because then you can really make an argument that Yamato can and maybe even should win. Like, I'm way more into that. I'm so much more into the idea of Yamato beating Shun, but Shun sticking around, than I am the idea of Shun winning the Dreamgate belt right now.
Yeah, no, like, I'm totally with you with that. And it was, like, such, like, putting your brain into a blender, having this happen just immediately after the match that Yamato had with Masaaki Mochizuki.
I mean, look, we can go to that now. Well, I mean, what else can you say about that? It was utterly brilliant. It was another defense for Yamato in what I think now is, you know, truly one of the all-time great Dreamgate runs of all time. I think you have to put it up there with Mochizuki in 2011, and I think we're really getting close to Shingo in 2015. I mean, let me pull these up side by side real quick, because I'm trying to rack my brain around Shingo and how many defenses he had. So if you combine the two, because I'll count everything from when he won it through World. I know he lost it to Susumu at some point, but it was It was Fuji, Mochizuki, Gamma, Shima, and then the two Susumu matches. And then after that, did he have one more? Oh, he had a Saito match at Wakayama, and that was bad because it was Shingo and Saito together. And then the Yamato match. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, we don't have the all-time great five-star classic, you know, in the same way that we had Shingo versus Mochizuki in 2015. But this Yamato run, which is now tied for, I think, I have it in my review, but I think it's the third most defenses in Dreamgate history. Benkei, Kakuta, Ishin, Kano, Daya, Strong Machine J, KZ, Jason Lee, which I think I like more than most people, and then Mochizuki. That is an incredible group of matches, and it's why I still think him being Dreamgate champion right now is just way more interesting than Shun being Dreamgate champion. I think there's more left of the tank here.
Yeah, and like you also still have the hidden weapon of, oh, well, we're spending time building up Yuki Oshioka as like, okay, this is kind of like the last shot of the Reiwa generation. You know, it's like you still have those interesting possible outcomes for him if he got past Shun here. But yeah, this match, just to run down the result, it was Yamato making the defense by corner stoppage as Daiki Yanagiuchi tosses the towel to do the corner submission, because Masaaki Mochizuki was in this overcraned crab, the same one he did against Daiki in the Bravegate match. And this was after he proceeded to basically dismantle Mochizuki's leg throughout like the period of the match, and being able to really put forth at 55 one of those like special performances that kind of only come out of Masaaki Mochizuki, where it did uniquely in the same way that it feels like he has had this before. This one, and you wrote about this in the review, did kind of feel like the Mochizuki Last Stand as a serious Dreamgate challenger.
It's the thing I'm most fascinated with Mochizuki, and I want to put a pin in this because I want to give that just a full thought. I really have a lot on the evolution of what a Mochizuki title match looks like. Just real quick, just to highlight some of the spots here. I think this match really ends up taking hold and taking shape after the Galleria for a one count, or even actually, you know, a segment before that. Mochizuki goes for a dragon suplex. Yamato gets out of it. Yamato goes for a German. Mochizuki lands on his feet. They trade big boots, and then Yamato goes for a Frankensteiner of the Almighty. Mochizuki hangs onto the ropes, but Yamato still clips him in the head. And I wrote in my review, it looked to me, and maybe this is just a gross comparison to some, but it felt like an 80s Triple Crown match looking at that. I mean, it was so violent and uncoordinated and awkward in a way that I thought really added to the match. And then you come out of that, and it's a Galleria for a one count. Mochizuki fights back. He gets a palm strike that knocks Yamato to the ground. I jumped out of my chair when he did that. They trade sleeper holds. They do all this great stuff. Mochizuki gets a choke in. It looks like he's going to choke Yamato out. And then Yamato, being not only the incredibly charismatic champion that he is, but also the tremendous mat wrestler that he is, he twists Mochizuki's ankles. He turns the submission that was on him into a submission of his own. From there, he's able to sort of, on the mat, grapple with Mochizuki. He goes from essentially an ankle lock on his back into the half crab, like you said. He wrenches in that half crab. Daiki throws the towel. That is, of course, relevant because 2 months ago, when it was Daiki versus Yamato for the Bravegate belt, it was Mochizuki throwing in the towel for Yamato. Excellent stuff there. I don't want to hear anything at this specific time about not your big brother's Dragon Gate. That is the type of stuff that in 2014, 2015, 2016, as a collective, we would have all lost our minds over. Excellent stuff there. But this match, I mean, my God, it got me fired up about the concept of Masaaki Mochizuki being a Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer, even if he has no chance.
Yeah, and just like the way that Yamato used the ankle pick as kind of like this thing that through his dragon twists and a previous ankle work, he was able to basically unlock this way to move out of a sleeper. And it was kind of brutal in of itself, the way that he picked him and transitioned into like that full crab for the moment before the wrench crab. It's like the unique special thing about Masaaki Mochizuki that like you have this match where you even have this moment where he does the Sengoku Gary and the Shinshaiko high kick, but in the back of your mind, you're going like, he needs to pull out the triangle kick. He needs to go up there, and that is going to have to be like the killing blow. But like the way that it was teased right into the go to hospital was just like one of those moments. I was like, oh, his ankle isn't so great, so Yamato sets him up for that because of that work. And it's just really, really just smart paying off of mat work in a style of match that necessarily, Yamato crossed the threshold for the most Dreamgate defenses with this match, that like you go through at least Yamato's run in 2016 and maybe coming out of his heel runs with the belt, and you weren't necessarily having that connective tissue and like those kind of defenses. And it really kind of took that one title loss to Mochizuki in 2017 to put a nice like little like check on that Yamato's like ace run back then. But you have like that experience and that kind of playing off here, where like Yamato is now forced to wrestle a lot more of a mental match against someone who is essentially going to be a Terminator until someone had to put him out of his misery, or else he was going to completely lose his knee ligaments.
Go back and watch Mochizuki and watch the agony that he demonstrates when Yamato puts him in the ankle pick at the very end of the match. It was the thing that really jumped out to me, is just, again, Mochizuki sort of being on another level than everybody else, because there's a lot of great offense. There's a lot of great selling throughout this contest, but it all comes to fruition in this amazing, amazing spot where, again, you know, for a brief moment in time, Mochi's got this choke in and it looks deadly for Yamato. And then for Yamato to not only outsmart him, but to do it in what ended up being such a vicious way, the Mochizuki response to that is utterly incredible. That, to me, is the single highlight of the match.
Yeah, and this is, like, when you, like, you think about Misaki-Mochizuki Dreamgate matches, this one felt like a different kind of mental performance that we got to see out of him, where it wasn't him, like, as the champion punishing people for, like, just having the temerity to challenge for the belt by just going after their win by attacking them in the stomach. This one was a lot more about him as this 55-year-old wrestler trying to survive. And maybe it's a situation where, I mean, we've seen basically this guy's active prime from 2000 to present, where you see this kind of match, your mind goes back to like 2011 or 2017. You're like, maybe Mochizuki hits that triangle kick and there's not like, and he's able to get on like a real streak and put away Yamato by the end of it. But instead, what you have is like the reality of like Misaki Mochizuki crossing 30 years as a pro wrestler, having perhaps one of his last major Dreamgate matches, and having that kind of be like an unspoken undertone throughout the match and the way he kind of worked it.
Like I said, this match, Mochizuki versus Yamato, it sort of reinvigorated my care in this idea that Mochizuki is going to be on the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame ballot this year. And this is something that I did not ask Dave for. When I submitted my last ballot, I think I asked for Gabe Sapolsky, Kenta, and Great Sasuke to be on the ballot. I might have asked him for Mochizuki in 2023, but this was not my doing. When I saw that Mochizuki was going to be on the list, I felt overwhelming dread, because to you and me, it's obvious that Mochizuki is a Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer, but I think he's going to get under 10% and fall off the ballot, and it's going to bum me out when it happens. But watching this match, it just hit me that no matter how many times I discover a new wrestler that I love, no matter how many times I dive into footage that I've never seen before that's excellent, no matter what I do, I always come back to the idea that Mochizuki is one of the 10 greatest wrestlers we've ever seen. You know, it's Kobashi, it's Hansen, it's Tenryu, it's Fujinami, it's Shingo, and it's Mochizuki. Like, those are my six. Those are the guys that I consistently have 1 through 6, no matter who else gets pushed in my way, no matter what style I might be more fond of at the moment. It's those six that continue to reign supreme in my mind. And I put in the Voices of Wrestling Discord, and this offer is open to anybody. If you happen to come across this audio, because I want to clip this out, maybe you're not a usual listener, maybe this ends up on the F4W board, I don't know, whatever. If you don't know about Mochizuki, or you don't feel like you know enough about Misaki Mochizuki, and you care about the Hall of Fame, please contact me. Let me know what I can do to help, because I now all of a sudden really care about the idea of Misaki Mochizuki being a Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer, because he deserves it, and because he should be in. And because, Mike, tell me if I'm wrong, but if he had this career in New Japan, or All Japan, or NOAH, or any American company, he would have already been in.
Oh, absolutely so. And if not, you would see similar to Taue, like, campaigns to get him in. You know, like, it's one of those things that, like, my real fear is the fact that the voters who are open-minded and would consider having like a spot for Mochizuki on the ballot, just because of like the Dragon Gate kind of barrier, or the fact that really with like Mochizuki, it is like, if you want to give like a list of his 4.5-star and or better matches case, it will take someone a considerable amount of time to get through that. So that's kind of intimidating with that. And that is like a legitimate fear that I have, because I feel like if anyone has a open mind and is willing to look at Mochizuki's like output, and especially, I'm not going to go on the Ishii argument and the parallels there with that, but it is something that's so like blatantly obvious, and it's been obvious for me at least like since like 2017, how brilliant it is, and then being able to go back and revisit some of his other like Toriumon work. And that's not even to say he was not necessarily bad as a plucky young Kratika in WAR as well. It's just one of those things that it is kind of hard a little bit to do the huge campaign for Mochizuki when it just seems like, and we'll probably have more of this kind of discussion here, it seems like so readily apparent with him in a lot of ways. But it if Shima got in, then I feel like then there's kind of a duty, and maybe there's a level of openness that someone like Mochizuki could get an appraisal. If Mochizuki can at least get an appraisal, then we can start talking about people like Dragon Kid, who I feel like have just as much should get discussion for just being on the ballot itself and having that actual look into that. Like, I feel like Mochizuki might be the key to that, maybe in some way.
Well, the tough thing, I mean, look, Ishii's the comp, because you can go through Mochizuki's career in the same way that people went through Ishii's career, and you can go, well, there's more of a drawing resume here than people give it credit for, and that is inherently true. But I have zero interest in discussing him as a draw. I have zero interest in discussing whatever influence case is there, and I think it's a very small one, if anything. It's purely an in-ring case, and the point to this is that it's 25 years. We'll chop off the first 6 years of his career from 94 to 99, because he's a very good indie-level junior heavyweight karate kickboxer guy.
Yeah.
At a time in which there were a lot of those. You know, he was one of the many good ones in the Japanese indies in the late 90s. I don't even find that part of his career to be worth discussing when we talk about him in the Hall of Fame. What I'm really looking at is 2000 to 2025. And I say this about Mochizuki, and I say this about Susumu, and I say this about Dragon Kid, and I've started saying this about Doi, is like, at some point, their longevity and their sense of agelessness is doing them tremendous harm. I need everybody to go through the thought experiment of, think about, you know, if we want to put the start of Ric Flair's peak at 1980. Okay, think about Ric Flair in 1980. Think about Ric Flair in the output of his work in 2005. And then think about Baba and Inoki and, you know, Misawa. You think about Misawa in 81 to Misawa in 2006. And it's not that they still couldn't go, but when you compare them to Mochizuki and Susumu and Doi and guys like that, it's not even close. We're talking about a different level of consistency, one that is so rarely seen, one that I still think is so greatly underappreciated. And I saw in the Voice of Wrestling Discord when I brought this up last night, I was, you know, telling people, okay, sell me on Mochizuki. You know, what don't you know? What can I help you with? Maybe at some point, just like I did with Shingo years ago, I'm pre-pandemic, when I wrote out all the 4-star Shingo matches and I got to like 230 and Rob Naylor loved it. It was a great big deal. Maybe I need to do that with Mochizuki. But one of the comments that came up was, it's almost hard to evaluate Mochizuki because he's been the same guy for 25 years. And I would never tell somebody they're wrong for thinking that. It's not the type of thing that you would start an argument over, but it was funny to me that that was said coming out of the Yamato match, because my takeaway from the Yamato match was how different this Mochizuki is than other eras of his career. And so, Mike, if you're interested, I sort of have a 4-part Mochizuki career experience and the way to view different eras of his career.
Yes, let's do the Mochizuki experience. Well, what's act one?
So I broke this up into years. I would go 2000 to 2004 as this first era of his career. And, you know, it's largely defined just by the existence of M2K at this point. But if you only know Mochizuki from, say, the last 10 years, if you only know him from the last Dreamgate reign from, you know, 2017 onwards, let's say, or maybe you picked up Dragon Gate during the pandemic, and you only know that era of Mochizuki, and then you haven't gone back and watched Torimon stuff, you know, Mochizuki in 2000 is a great wrestler. 2000 is the first year that he's really, really great. Like, he's got good matches, 97, 98, 99. 2000, he's really great. You know, I think DVDVR that year, I think he finished like 49 or 50 in their top 500. So obviously, even at that time, well thought of by some of the greatest minds in wrestling criticism. But 2000 to 2004, it's Mochizuki matches that are great, but they're incredibly character heavy. You know, he's not playing stoic badass. He is playing young Japanese punk, and he's doing that against Shima and Crazy Max, and he's tormenting Doofixer, and he's got, you know, towards the end of that run, the Italian connection is in the mix. But it's a Mochizuki that is largely heel, still works with an incredible motor, but is doing all of these interesting brawling matches and all this charisma you know, I look at a match like 824-2000, which is the first M2K Crazy Max Trios match in Korakuen where they do the double countout. And just what an animal Mochizuki is from a charisma and a character standpoint. You look at him and Magnum from El Numero Uno 2001 and how great of a match that is. The hair versus hair match with Shima in 2001. What a great match that is. You skip ahead a few years, all of a sudden you've got matches like Mochi and Arakan and Dragon Kid versus Genki, Saito, and Susumu 6-29-03. That is a work rate fest, but it's, again, it's driven by this character that Mochizuki brings to the mix. And then you look at something like Mochizuki versus Dragon Kid, April 28th, 2004, where Mochizuki is an asshole in that match, and he does it better than anybody else. That era, 2000 and 2004, is a drastically different Mochizuki than even the one we get in 2005, let alone beyond.
Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it, it's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line, now 20% lower. Family plans, also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone. All with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Yeah, and I would say that if you kind of want to look at it at in a certain way of like Mochizuki's development, a lot of that character work, I feel like being like his backbone, like transitioning over from doing like battle arts and various other indies other than WAR, I feel like that it really helped him kind of work up to speed, especially with like kind of the speed that you were getting out of Dragon Kid in 99 and 2000, the speed that Magnum had really and Shima up until his knees went, like there is like that aspect that by the time you're getting to those later incarnations of M2K and like the Arakan and Dragon Kid stuff here, like very like subtly throughout like 3 years, like Masaaki Mochizuki gets faster and faster and faster, and kind of becomes in a way, like even though like being like this vicious brawler and still like deploying the karate background, he kind of becomes like refined by the end of final M2K, and especially when you then have him be a veteran heel leader in Agon Iso, ending out that era going into 2005.
I totally agree with all that. And then you move into the next era of his career, and I had this marked 2005 to 2010 as sort of the, I marked it in my notes as the heavy leg era, where you see Mochizuki, like especially pre-Toriumon, you see him as this, you know, karate guy, very athletic, throws a lot of strikes and throws a lot of good strikes. But something changes in the mid to late 2000s where all of a sudden he really leans into that act. And the edge that was there in the early days of M2K is gone. At this point, he's the veteran presence on a very young roster, but even by 2006, you know, it's the story of, you know, Mochizuki was going to retire at the end of 2005, and then he obviously never went anywhere. But, you know, by 2006, 2007, it's this heavy leg era of Mochizuki. You start to see him and Fuji, and you start to see younger guys on the roster that Mochizuki can mutilate. And you top that off with, in 2005, he has what is considered to be a legendary Dreamgate run. So you look at 2005 to 2010 as him versus Saito in 2005, the second Dragon Gate Ring of Honor six-man tag Supercard of Honor 2 2007. Look at what Mochizuki does in that match. He is killing people with his strikes in a way that he wouldn't do in, say, 2002 or 2003, and in a way that would feel out of place almost a little bit later in his career. But in 2007, that is his mode of operation. Mochi Fuji versus Doin Yoshino from 2008, Mochi Fuji versus Shingon Yamato from Gate of Destiny 2009 is an all-timer. And then, of course, I put down Mochizuki versus Yamato from 2010, their first Dreamgate match, because that's really what got me thinking about all of this, is the stark contrast between the way that Mochizuki Yamato has worked in 2010 and the way that Mochizuki Yamato has worked in 2025. And by no means is this like an all-time great wrestling feud, but I do think it speaks to the fact that the people that have been able to evolve in world title matches against one another, it's the Misawa Kawada types, it's the Tanahashi Okada types, it's the Kobashi Misawa types. Yamato Mochizuki, let me be clear, not in the same stratosphere, but they've been able to pull off a thing that not everybody can do. Sometimes wrestlers wrestle 10 years apart and the match is the same as it was in both incarnations. There's been a natural evolution with Mochizuki working on top in 2010 and then what we'll get to, Mochizuki working from underneath in 2025. Are you on the same page in terms of this run, 2005 to 2010, as being the time in which Mochizuki really leaned into his striking ability?
Yeah, and this also, like, you bring up the Fuji team, and he is, like, purely at this point that veteran presence. He starts Zetzer ends around, like, the idea of him and Fuji still being able to go as the real old guys in their mid to late 30s on the roster. And I just vividly, and maybe it is because my affection for Akira Tozawa, thinks so highly of the Zetzer ends versus Tozawa Juku feud and leading up to that title match versus graduation 2007 Gate of Destiny match. And it is really like at a time that like I feel like that Mochizuki doing this in 2005 through 2010 is like he was doing this way too early, like that style of wrestling for like the appreciation of the types that would appreciate grumpy old man beating up young guys.
And also, you know, once he gets out of that Dreamgate run in 2005, this is probably the era of his career. I don't want to say least pushed, but 2006 to 2010, he has Dreamgate challenges, but the promotion doesn't feel like his, you know, the way history is written makes sense. Where there's that gap in, you know, of 6 years between his Dreamgate runs.
Right. And like a big deal was made as we move into like the 2010, 2011, 2012 period that becomes like so ingrained in a lot of fans of that era's time because of the Junction 3 and Blood Warriors all out war. But you had that only really start because Blood Warriors was at such a huge point where Masaaki Mochizuki basically had to pull together the other three face units and go, guys, we got to get together. I'm stepping up and as Dreamgate champion, like starting that Dreamgate run from 2010 to 2011, really kind of put him on as like the veteran presence up top of the cards after the first run through for the soon to be Big Six, like the big like stabilizing kind of run that he would have as the eras would change.
And that's when you get into 2011 through 2017, which I would label as his absolute prime. It is, and somebody mentioned this in the Discord last night, it's 20 years into his career, you know, as we get into the bulk of his prime, which is bizarre. But Mike, you and I have watched more Mochizuki than most people. This is the best he ever got, was 2011 through specifically, and this is relevant to the post-prime, but it's 2011 through the KZ match February 2018. That is prime Mochizuki, where he walks in the ring, he is respected, he is at times the ace, he is at times the best wrestler in the world, or at the very least the best wrestler in the promotion. It is Misaki Mochizuki as the top dog. All should fear him. You think about the Hulk match at World 2011, the Tozawa match, the Yoshino match in Korakuen, the Shingo match, all the millennial stuff that he did, the Shimizu match in 2017, which is so underrated, the top 10 match for me in 2017, Mochizuki Shimizu from that September 2017 Korakuen show. It is prime Mochizuki at his best.
Yeah, and I think that this is a point that I hammer home with him, is that February 2018 match against KZ, and just the fact that like you get a real perspective watching him through his prime, the idea that this is someone who thinks about wrestling, maybe not in a deeper level, but he thinks about wrestling in ways that other people don't. And that title match, well, I talked about it earlier on this episode, was all based around Mochizuki being like the giant wall for KZ and basically giving him a literal gut check throughout the match until KZ just was not able to go on anymore, and Mochizuki put him into the dirt. No one has done matches like that really since then, and no one other than Kenny Omega now because of diverticulitis now making that a selling point in his matches. But no one was doing that, and no one really works in that style and thinks about wrestling in that kind of way. And that's not even getting into Gate of Destiny 2015, the time where Dave Meltzer famously said that this was better than any Shawn Michaels performance in his career, and then did not really rate the match. Like, there's still a level of consternation about that, but he has like two of, I would consider, the top five Dreamgate matches of all time within a 24-month period during this time.
Yeah, and the reason that I use that KZ match as the demarcation point is, you think about that match and where KZ was at in his career, first Dreamgate challenge for him, Mochizuki at this point, third Dreamgate run. Again, we're in prime Mochizuki when that match happens. His next Dreamgate defense is the first Dreamgate match that Ben K has. And it's the first time that Mochizuki looks like an underdog to the younger generation. And it kicks off this post-prime run where you could point to that Ben match. You could point to the Shun Skywalker match in May of 2019 that I still think is the most underrated post-2018 split Dragon Gate match there is. I think that match had so much to do with the Shun Skywalker we see today. I think it was incredibly influential. I think it was utterly phenomenal. It held up on rewatch when I watched it last year. Mochizuki versus Shun from 2019, the Yoshioka match from 2022, the Mochizuki Jr. matches, and then this Yamato match. And it all hit home with me because I didn't rewatch the 2011 Yamato match with Mochi, and I didn't rewatch the 2017 match the two had, but I did rewatch the 2010 match, and then I watched the 2025 match. And the difference in those two, of Mochizuki in 2010, with Yamato being the young upstart Dreamgate champion, his first reign, being overwhelmed by Mochizuki's offense, being overwhelmed by his strikes, working from underneath as a fighting champion, to 2025, where Mochizuki is older and he's wounded and he's slower and Yamato has the upper hand on him almost throughout the entire match. It's the quickness, it's the IQ of Mochizuki in those very brief moments that puts him ahead of Yamato, but it's Yamato dominating 15 years later. And that's when it really dawned on me that Mochizuki has had this incredible post-prime run now, some of which, again, you know, we don't talk about the pre-Toriumon stuff. I'm not going to mention the Noah stuff because he's really a Noah wrestler more than he is a Dragon Gate wrestler in 2020 and 2021. And a lot of that Noah stuff is awesome. There's a Shiozaki match that is utterly incredible. And it just goes to show the list of Mochizuki great matches. It is endless. He is truly one of the smartest wrestlers I've ever seen. He's one of the most exciting wrestlers I've ever seen. He's one of the most talented wrestlers I've ever seen. He is, simply put, one of the greatest pro wrestlers to ever live. And I really hope that as we get into Hall of Fame season, more people see it that way.
Absolutely. And that was not the only stellar title match on this Corcoran Hall show. The first time that Dragon Gate held all four title matches during a Tokyo Corcoran Hall show, I'm just going to take it backward. The semi-main event was Minoli making only their second defense of this run, defeating Not Hug with a Golden Rose after a really like strong match. I felt like in a lot of ways, I felt like that, as much as I know that you are in particularly pretty high on this, this felt like the most complete kind of heel Kota Minoura a match that we've had so far, and it did not kind of degrade into the stuff that you've seen in a lot of Minoli matches in this heel run of being overly reliant on the referee distraction, low blows or belt shots and stuff like this. It just felt like a strong Twin Gate match to me.
I did love the Jay anecdote on commentary that I guess was done in character, but boy, was it illuminating that Coach Minoura has been giving interviews in which he's like, I don't want to be a leader. I'm not the leader type. Just let me be a part of the team, basically. And I love Coach Minoura when he's part of the team, not leading anything. And we got that here.
Yeah. And I think that like that character wise or just like positioning wise is kind of like the natural comfortable thing, is it's like, hey, now Kakuta's there to be like the true 1A there. But this one, I just really enjoy the fact that like you had this sort of tag match where you had like the natural thing working over Dragon Kid, and how much like that's just like it really just is able to kind of key things up, and especially like the beatdown that he was kind of getting from like Jason Lee, and then he gets like that momentary Poison Rana setting up what was like a near fall sequence, and with that it just really felt like they brought up Nut Hug and did the match that kind of was left on the table with Nut Hug in a lot of ways in that first run. And in this way, now Jason Lee and Kota Minoru, they advance on. We'll talk about their likely Kobe World situation when we talk a little bit about 6-5, but just a strong Twin Gate match. Like, I was 4-flat on it, but I just was really, I thought it was kind of like really remarkable where it's like, oh yeah, no, these are like the two dominant teams of this era going at it and having just like a just solid semi-main event Twin Gate match.
I wrote in my review, as sick as it is, as wrong as it is, the Dragon Kid neck injury has provided all of his matches with an entirely different level of drama that otherwise we just wouldn't get. And I welcome it. So I really like Dragon Kid in this match. And I really like what Minoli did here.
Absolutely. The Triangle Gate match. Then we have new Open the Triangle Gate champions as Natural Vibes failed in their first defense. They'll go down with zero on this time, as the Young Brats team of Ishin, Yoshiki Kato, and Hamare become Open the Triangle Gate champions. Hamare finishing off a closing stretch on Straw Machine J with his Fired Bird Splash. This was, I think I liked the Brave Gate a little bit more than this, but outside of the Dream Gate part of me, this really like, The whole story playing into it with SMJ getting his mask torn and how that plays off also going into 6-5, really a strong, compelling bit of booking throughout it. And I just, Hamare, every single time that he gets put into these scenarios, now that he's kind of out of his training wheel phases, more and more you see this guy. And I know we're out of 30 season, but like you watch it, this him becoming a champion for the first time, and so abundantly clear that the track that Hamari is on is going to basically have us a lot over the next decade discuss him possibly as one of the best wrestlers under the age of 30, if not in Japan, in the entire world.
This had to have been one of my favorite Strong Machine J performances ever. You know, I think the combination of this, the opening match on the next night, and then his run-in in the main event on the 6-5 show, it all made Strong Machine J feel really fresh. You know, I he had a hard reset because of the injury after the Yamato match in January. And I still have, I don't know if issue is the right word, I still have a hard time fully embracing the idea of this being Strong Machine J's natural vibes. And I wonder sometimes.
That's always been, I feel like, since he's been named the leader, it hasn't felt like that it's like a unit based around him.
No, I wonder if that's holding him back slightly. But all of a sudden, like when his mask gets ripped and he shows this edge, it's like, oh my God, this could be what Strong Machine J's natural vibes looks like. This is not just what we've been seeing, but with him named the leader instead of KZ, this kind of feels like something different. This feels a little bit more rogue. This feels a little bit more militant. And I really like this. This is really good.
Yeah, and I feel like that you have this match where like Hamari makes a point of going after Strong Machine J. He gets the mask torn and he kind of becomes like this absolute like feral beast. And it's a shame that there was kind of the botch with the Flamita mask rip as it got later on in this match, because it just felt like you had like a different kind of energy. It, also with like this particular Z-Brats team, you have Ishin, who is just at this point, it's almost an issue how much how over he is. You know that like it's perfect for him because he could take losses and nothing matters because he gets his heat back. But you're kind of like, you're just a splendid idiot. And he's paired with a young Terminator in Hamare and Kato, who I felt like was like the one person in this match who was kind of a step behind. I enjoyed him more on the next night, I'd have to say.
I guess the weird thing with the mask spot, for those that didn't see it, Kato rips Flamita's mask off, and then they brawl a little bit longer. The referee's not quite looking at it, so Flamita gets his mask back, and then they rip his mask off again and shove Flamita into the referee. I think it was a botch. I wrote it down as a botch. Maybe it was just a bad spot. I don't know what the end game there was. That was frustrating. But I do have to know, you mentioned Ishin. The Ishin-Flamita chemistry is a million times better than it should be.
Yeah, God. I know that Ishin now is working heavyweight in a lot of ways, but the way he's able to like move and work with Flamita, and Flamita now like as like middle-aged Flamita, I know he's only like 30. I shouldn't say he's middle-aged, but you know what I kind of mean from it. Like there was a fun, good chemistry there. Like if this was to end up like a King of Gate match, I would be intrigued given their interactions in this one.
Yeah, they had a King of Gate match last year. That's how we did to make tape. That was a real bummer. But no, I really liked this match a lot. I thought Hamara was incredible. Ishin was incredible. Flamita was just, as he continues to be, absolutely amazing. But then also, this felt like, I don't know if Strong Machine Jake coming out party is the right phrase. That feels demeaning for where he's at in his career. It was a noticeably strong Machine Jake performance.
Yeah, and it felt like that after coming back from his injury, he kind of just stepped in and Rey de Parejas, like, and we were treating it like nothing happened. He stepped in and they became Triangle Gate champions, and it just, in a lot of ways, feels like that the Jay character kind of took a step in this match into some new direction. It's also worth noting in the post-match, Madoka Kakuta absolutely obliterated Strong Machine Jay on the microphone that would play into the next night. Our first of the title matches on 6-4 was for the Open the Brave Gate Championship, UT making his first successful defense with the Bien Llave Perfecto, forcing Junior to tap out. And I've seen people say like this is that they like this match more than the main event, and I don't necessarily go that far, but for a UT title match and the idea of like UT as a Brave Gate champion being kind of like the if not the wall of Yamato, the roadblock of UT for the young generation, that felt like we got a lot of that in this match, and Junior just getting better and better, best shape of his career, I would say, in this match, and engaging in his dad's action, doing the Senkaiku high kick along with the Sengoku Gary.
I was blown away by this. It's just so much fun watching Junior. I mean, I would say half of this roster now you and I have been covering on this platform, you know, in either the written word or an audio for their entire careers now, when you think about the turnover that's been there over the last decade. But Junior is just one of those guys that I think specifically you and I feel the same way about and have felt the same way about since his debut. And to see him continue to evolve from being in really big matches but being protected to being this really great tag team wrestler to having the matches with Ishin that he should have and the matches with Strong Machine Jay that he should have, you know, in the second generation stuff, to now here where it's a dog off of a chain. And Junior was such an animal in this match. And the great thing about UT is that despite his injury-prone nature and despite his small frame and the fact that he's not a striker, he is animalistic in his own way. And UT brought everything that Junior was bringing to him in this match, and what just ended up being another Brave Gate match that for whatever reason for me topped out at 3 3/4 and not 4, but an awesome Brave Gate match, well worth your time.
Yeah, I just like the idea of UT being like the actual Yaveo and basically going like, oh, okay, you're kicking me a lot. I'm just going to, in certain places, be able to anticipate, and especially in the closing stretch, eating the bridging suplex, be like, oh, your wrist is a little free on this bridge. I think I can transition out of this, and being able to transition into the Bien Llave and then into the Perfecto is just kind of fun stuff in a manner that's just like, oh, he is having really fun title matches after having like the moment that it's like, okay, that's the peak UT moment. You can get the Brave Gate off of him at any time now after winning it at Dead or Alive. Seeing this title match wants me to have a lot more UT Brave Gate matches, and especially like the idea of UT versus Rita is a Brave Gate match I really want to see.
I love, and normally I would complain about this because it would be finishes on the same show that I think are too similar. I love that in the Dreamgate match, Yamato goes from that ankle pick into the half crab and never really gets up off the mat. And here, it was UT doing that key lock out of the counter of the German into the Bienyave for perfecto. You don't see in wrestling a lot anymore guys sprawl on the mat the way that they did there. I loved both of those finishes. The perfecto is a gnarly submission. UT has found his super finisher in that. In terms of UT's Brave Gate run, couldn't agree with you more. Would love a Rita match. Not going to happen, though, because I think he's going to get killed by Tanaka at Kobe World.
Yeah, but we'll have to see what will be UT's fight card there. And those are the things of consequence from 6-4. There was a original Jimmy's and Hulk versus Shun, Kakuta, and Kai match that Shun looked like it was going to be basically the finish, I thought. Tearing through Kage, he goes down hard off an SSW. Ref pulls up at 2. They stop the match. He goes to the back. They get him to the back later on. He ends up Jay saying on commentary that he was fine, which was a scary moment. But I felt like that kind of was the finish of that match in that way. But before the ref pulled up there.
I agree. I thought the match was going to be over. It all pointed to the match being over. If I had one say in Drangate, it would be that they've got to start counting pinfalls like it's a shoot. They can't keep on doing this.
Yeah, it's a situation that, I mean, obviously a scary situation, and things turned out for the best there, but it is a situation, and it feels like that was Sato doing that one, Duke Sato, right?
Yes, but I read it as they played it off like Kagetora was hurt, but I think Kagetora was fine.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, I feel like these issues happen with Duke Sato whenever they're in Tokyo and using his ring versus Yagi, Kashi-san, or even when Nakagawa's around.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
But that was 6-4. I had the written review for 6-5. I think really with the time remaining, we'll talk about the big moments on that show. And I think like the first place to go to is the main event. D-Courage, Yuki Yoshioka, Dragon Dai, and Ryu Tanaka finally getting their hands on Madoka Kakuta after the cage match from the month previous with the Champion Carnival and Best of the Super Juniors. They really did not have time and the people in the right place to do a Kakuta versus D-Courage match. But we got it here, and it was Kakuta getting the win solidly with a rolling lariat in the post-match. Ryo Saito came out and said, "We need Yuki Yoshioka back. You're in your slump. I have a match for you at Kobe World that will pull you out of that slump. It's you and Daya versus Dragon Kid and X." So a strong main event, and then our second match announced for Kobe World coming out of it on 6-5.
Is that going to be Shingo?
I wonder if they're going to try to do... one, if they're going to announce the X, and if they announce the X, would they try to get Tanahashi one last time?
Oh, I don't think so.
Shingo would be the X then if it's not Tanahashi. I just thought that with Tanahashi's clock that they would try to get a date for him before he's done.
Let me think. Okay, so they're teaming with Dragon Kid and they're not announcing it. Yeah, I'm not going to overthink this. I'm just going to say Shingo. What I'd rather talk about is the D-Courage stuff here. I've been very critical. I don't want to put you and I in the same group here. I've been very critical of Yoshioka since he returned from injury. Not in the sense of, I don't think this guy's ever going to get his mojo back, but it's just been noticeable to me how his mojo hasn't been there. And I've been more and more concerned about it. I wasn't worried about it in Rey de Parejas. I was a little worried about it in April when I thought Kakuta was just eating him up a lot of the time. And in May, it was just like, God, I understand Dai is at New Japan right now, but he kind of feels like an afterthought again. Yoshioka, I thought, was phenomenal on both of these shows. That was really exciting to see. And if that wasn't enough, and again, this is no slight to Dragon Dai, but Oh my God, Ryoya Tanaka. We are on the cusp of Ryoya Tanaka being a capital A, capital G, A guy.
Yeah, and this is after him being the highlight in the opener on 6-4, getting a win with two crossovers in a row. He follows it up kind of being the workhorse of D Courage in this match, and especially like when you like see his work against both Hamari and Kakuta when they had those chances in this match. It's going to happen real, real soon for Tanaka. I didn't manage to write a whole lot about him in my review for it, but I guess for me, if Yoshioka, I always kind of looked at the long play, and as soon as Rey de Parejas ended up the way it was, and it very clearly was going to go directing towards a D Courage in the cage, I figured it was going to be a much longer rehab project. So it does like make you wonder at Rey de Parejas, when he didn't really necessarily show that he had the juice, and like with this, is this a situation where maybe the circumstances changed around with him coming back a little bit, or is it a situation where 13 months is a hell of a layoff? There was no way he was going to have it all the way back immediately.
I think it was that. I just think he needed reps, and that's why I wasn't really worried of Rey de Parejas, because I didn't think he was going to hit the ground running there, especially given the nature of the injury. April, I think he was fine. It was just Kakuta was so much better. Last month is when I started to get worried. And again, I know Dio was gone, but it was just like, man, he's just, I don't know if he can hang with the Kakutas in the shoes. I was worried he wasn't going to be a main eventer anymore, but he won me back over this weekend.
Yeah, he wasn't, like, without Dio, it was him and Tanaka doing undercard work. It just didn't necessarily give you any reason for encouragement there, I would say.
Well, him and Tanaka doing undercard work, with Tanaka just on a show-in-show-out basis right now, blowing me away. I mean, Tanaka was outstanding in the opener on the 6-4 show, and I thought was the best guy on the 6-5 show, period. The best guy on the 6-5 show, period.
Yeah, and that's on top of the fact that Kakuta just has become one of the must-watch wrestlers in the world right now with his new heel attribute. It's amazing.
I love those kicks that Kakuta does. Those little, when a guy is kneeling, he does these like toe forward kicks that feel very, they feel very pro wrestling Noah in the most complimentary way. It looks like it's just a very painful short kick to either the chest or the face or whatever it is. I really like those. Kakuta, I mean, I'm blown away. I think he has hit every scenario out of the park so far in Z-Brats.
Yeah, it's been an absolute blast. Semi-main event we had was the Mask All-Star match that was made a couple weeks back. Dragon Kid teaming with El Desperado. The heel team ended up being Shun Skywalker and Ishin, and she was going to buy a ticket to go to the show since she had the night off anyway, but instead, Starlight Kid ends up managing the Mask team, and the All-Stars win this match. Despy getting the doing a octopus stretch at the same time as Dragon Kid hitting Ishin with a Ultra Hurricanrana, and what felt like just a fun kind of all-star match. And it was just kind of a neat thing to see like the relationships that Dragon Kid has like formed in with like his position in the industry getting to pay off in a Dragon Gate ring versus him showing up in other places.
The spot in which Ishin broke up a pin by doing a frog splash that Shun Skywalker was on the bottom of was absolutely fantastic. This to me was, you know, Dragon Kid was impressive in the sense that you could tell this was a Dragon Kid match in the Dragon Kid universe that was showcasing the Dragon Kid influence. It is in these moments when Ishin is either in an unfamiliar setting like he was in Las Vegas, or he's with wrestlers that are outside of the Dragon Gate universe, or he's with the most popular wrestlers in Dragon Gate, whether it be a big match with Shun or a match against a guy like Dragon Kid, it's when you see that Ishin is so clearly one of the 30 best wrestlers under 30 and one of the most charismatic wrestlers in the entire world.
He's figured it out for him. And it's such like a cool thing to see that like he eats his finish and then the next day in Saitama, nothing changes because he's figured it out and he gets his heat back immediately. It's like one of those like situations where as soon as someone has like figured it out, especially for someone like Ishin, who's still, he's up on the roster and he's like been moved up a lot over the last few years, but like he's still like 5 years in, they go like, oh, that's awesome. You figured this out, Ishan. It's a nice thing to see. And Shun had probably the most disturbing costume that he's had in a long time in this match.
Yeah, I thought a very good match, but more than that, it felt like an all-star game of charisma. Like I thought they all worked shockingly hard. I mean, even I thought Despy brought it. I thought he was maybe the least interesting of the bunch, but it wasn't like Despy was totally mailing it in. But what it was, and it's interesting looking at this, any sort of match like this that happens during a time in Japanese wrestling like this, where the economy is still so weak and the fans just aren't there in the way that they should, you know, not a sellout on the first night, which I think is brutal with the four title matches, a slightly better house on the second night, but again, not a sellout with the Despy involvement. That is brutal. That is just a sign that for whatever reason, things are not clicking in the way that I think they should be, because I'm really enjoying the product. But it was just interesting watching four capital S stars work this match. I thought it was entirely carried by their charisma and their personality. And again, Ishan beating the drum more so than anybody, with the obvious structure of a Dragon Kid match sort of cocooning this environment. But it was just fascinating for me to see all of these guys work in this superstar-like way that I don't think a lot of people in Japan can do right now.
Yeah, and you had that Starlight Kid spots towards the end, and it's like, yeah, nope, this is when this should be happening. This makes sense. And it just really felt like a nice kind of change of pace on, if you look at the show's kind of complimentary, having this kind of match the next night after four title matches felt like it kind of gave an air of levity to the shows. And also the fact that you came back from intermission, and especially the way that you went to the intermission with the Dragon Bane injury, it felt like the right thing to do in front of a crowd that you've probably worked that has seen you for like 6 hours over the last 2 days, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we could talk about it briefly. Just the bad luck of Flamita and the scariness of that injury. I'll hand it to you for the details there, but really scary stuff. And what should have been a joyous celebration for Luis Monte.
Yeah, this was Luis Monte's 20th anniversary match. He is teaming with Ultimo and Flamita versus Bendito and Los Golpeadores, Alpha Wolf and Dragon Bane. The match was called off after Dragon Bane injured his neck on a Tiger Driver reversal. And it was a situation where, in case we've seen this kind of spot happen a lot, especially with like Lucha Libre and sometimes with in Japanese wrestling, you go for a Tiger Driver / Liger Bomb and you go up for it and then you're reversing it into a Rana Hold. It's something that I feel like we've probably seen hundreds of times. This time, maybe it was just done a little late. He ends up landing on his bent neck, was scarily unresponsive. Fortunately, Dragon Gate and were able to quickly put him on a stretcher and take him to the back. In the days since, we fortunately become aware that he only suffered a concussion, and that was just a real just bummer of a situation. Obviously, it's good that Dragon Bane only had a concussion, but it's just another kind of scary moment on what has been, you know, kind of happening on moments that we have on spots and stuff that we've seen like millions of times before.
It was scary to me the way that Alpha Wolf reacted. And that was the terrifying part, was not knowing in real time what was going on with Dragon Bane, but seeing such obvious concern in a way that I would say we don't normally see in a wrestling ring for any injury. It really freaked me out. Somebody made the point of comparison that it reminded them of Parasito, his death, Paraguayo Jr. And that was what I, because I was watching it live. I had it going on my computer, and that was my thought as well. Was like, oh, that might have gone wrong in every way possible in a way that's going to make this a really, really sad show to review. But I guess we're in a position where we can say, luckily it was a concussion, which is awful, but I'll take that over anything else.
Yeah, no, I mean, like what? It definitely a situation that we have seen go a lot worse, and did definitely have those moments of fear. And, you know, hopefully he is able to recover from the concussion quickly and get back to it, because the match itself, like every time you see him and his brother in Dragon Gate are wrestling people with Dragon Gate, it becomes really clear how well they would fit in Dragon Gate, even if it was just being an outsider tag team for Rey de Parejas. And it just makes it kind of a bummer that the match ends on that note and with those kinds of fears.
I would trade Coach Minora and a dojo prospect to be named later for Alpha Wolf, Dragon Bane, and Alejandro to join Dragon Gate full time. I'd do that in a heartbeat.
But do you think that Alejandro believes in love and peace, Case?
I think Alejandro would be a perfect fit in love and peace.
Well, let's close out talking about 6-5 with the real main event that ended up being match four. Gold Class contra Love and Peace. This kind of developed over Hokkaido as a thing where Rita and Jackie were getting tired of Benkei just being Benkei, thinking that the thing that we have to do now, clearly, since we have Hyo, is rebrand as Love and Peace. He ropes in Mochizuki Jr. Hyo is the referee. This really is like a 30-minute segment sandwiched around a three-star comedy match. But the end of it was Mochizuki Jr. getting tired of Benkei being Benkei. He quote-unquote turns on Benkei, assists Rita with the Rita Tanic to win. So Gold Class stays. But then Kota Minora comes out to rain on the parade, saying that he still has ownership over Gold Class. And however, if he wants this to remain Gold Class Rita, he has to be the Minorita mascot. The five of them quickly refuse, and all of them basically said that they were growing fonder of Love and Peace by the day, by a name Hyo. Hyo mentioning that he was becoming a fan of Love and Peace over Gold Class, sent Benkei to praise the heavens, and then they sent away Minora with a warning that Love and Peace will be coming for his Twin Gate belt. So we'll see what combination of Min Oli, probably Ben and Hyo, I would guess, be challenging at World. But then Benkei did one of the things that I just love about Benkei at this point, like speaking about how Ishin figured it out. When Benkei figured it out and realized I can play into being kind of a buffoon and the crowd kind of likes it, He decided to do a formal show close promo, Case, and ending with a debut of the Love and Peace theme song. It was quite a half hour of content.
It very much falls into one of those. It's the unique relationship you have with Dragon Gate sometimes where I don't like it, but I have to respect it. I would have kept the Gold Class branding. I would have played the... To come full circle, we talked about stipulations at the beginning of the show. I would have played the stipulation a little bit more true to what they did. I don't like the rebranding, but I got to hand it to them. You ever once, I got to hand it to them. A very entertaining segment. Ultimately, I don't see it changing much about the presentation of this unit. I certainly hope it doesn't change the presentation of this unit. I want it to stay the same because in ring, they are firing on all cylinders right now. I don't want any change other than the name. Man, this just seems like a lot of effort to divert away from something, you know, being the Gold Class branding that seemed like it was finally working 3 years after it began.
Yeah, because they just stopped kind of any like pretense and they just kind of were being five just idiots and just kind of having great matches. And it feels like that a lot of them kind of feed off Benkei's goofiness. So like the cohesion was always there. It just seems like that they're just going to kind of be kind of like goofball Jimmy's like baby faces. And that's kind of more what I kind of expect looking at the segment. But who's to say next time this weekend in Hakata, they show up and Jackie Kamei still has like the white pants on and they're just basically Gold Class with a new theme song.
That works for me, that sort of modern day Jimmy's comp, because I think that's something that Rita and Jackie and Ben specifically can thrive in, and I don't think Junior would lose his edge as a result there. So I'm okay with that, but man, just
plays into Hyo's strengths too.
Yeah, thank you. I knew I was forgetting somebody. Hyo, I mean, my God, I mean, he would be Jimmy Hyo in a heartbeat if he came along 10 years earlier than he did. So I get it. I'm fine with it. Man, it was just a lot of work for nothing, really.
Yeah. If you're looking at this as traditional setup and payoff, there was no payoff whatsoever. But in the same way, the payoff was excellent if you enjoy their shtick.
Yeah, that traditional payoff, not so much. Very funny.
Traditional payoff, the only thing we know is that, hey, it looks like that they could actually get theme music made now again.
And maybe Jack gets new gear again. I would love to know. I've said this before. I would love to know if Jack was going to join Gold Class all along, or if they just happened to stumble into this Jack Rita versus Flamita Monte match in December, and they're like, well, we've got to run with that now. And thus, here we are. And I don't know if you've seen the Fukuoka cards, but they're doing that match in Fukuoka again.
I have not seen the Fukuoka cards just yet, but that makes...
They're good, but yeah, they're doing Jack and Rita versus Monte and Flamita for the third time now, which is excellent. I love that. Run it in every single town you book. I'm all for it.
Yeah, and at least for like doing that like in Fukuoka, I mean, you got to do stuff across the days, you know what I mean? It's like a interesting situation going into those weekends and those shows case. Like if you like think about it, they do like they had this period of like no TV. And then now that they have a Sambo show coming up, and then they have Cork and Hall. They have like their first Edeon Arena show in July. And then they're back in Kobe before Kobe World. Like there's a lot of like interesting places that they can go to as they kind of build out what will be a Kobe Pro Wrestling Festival coming up to us in July.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. As I've said for most of this year, I feel like the booking in this promotion, the Yamato Dreamgate run has taken care of the top end of the card completely, and then you also get the Kakuta Shun Zebrat stuff, which, by the way, not to belabor this point, because I know we've talked about the possibility of this before, but assuming a Shun face term is coming, Mike, don't you feel so much better at the thought of Shun and Kakuta being the lead face in Shun and the lead heel in Kakuta than Shun and Minoru? It doesn't that just make a world of difference?
And especially knowing that Kakuta has like taken to this like to such a level, you know, like I really feel like Kakuta is ready that if this goes the way we expect it to, whatever Zebrats ends up being will be in a healthy place because Kakuta has kind of filled that role. We think about Zebrats, they've never really had that 1A. I mean, especially if you think about the idea of Kota Minoura's heel turn kind of intentionally putting him back down the card a little bit, you know, like they haven't had that. And now Shun turns and you're ready to go off to the races with a Kakuta-led heel unit.
Yeah, I'm all for it. You know, I really think this Kakuta's run has been great. It is clear they're doing something with Shun. I'll let it play out. They have earned my trust up to this point. If this was 2023, a year removed from the Minoru debacle, I would be biting my nails to the bone at this point. I'm gonna let them see where they go with this. Gold Class into 11 piece, same deal. I will throw my hands up and give you the benefit of the doubt. Whatever they do with Shun Skywalker, we'll see where it goes. I would say tread lightly. Don't go too far. I don't want to lose the magic that we have in Shun, but I do think this promotion right now has earned a little bit of, hey, let's see where this goes.
Hey, Strong Machine J right now versus Kakuta at World as like a special singles match. I'm all here for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And then, so that raised an interesting point. And then we'll go. But Shun Yamato, Kakuta SMJ, you're going to have a Zebrats Triangle Gate match and a Zebrats Twin Gate match.
What
do you do with Hamari at World?
I mean, Hamari will be in the Triangle Gate match.
Oh, that's right. He's Triangle Gate champion. Never, I was thinking it was Ishin and Kai. Kato and Kai.
Yeah, no. What's Kai going to do at World?
Kai is going to do a 4-minute undercard tag match. He is going to get paid to do very little work that night.
Soon, playing the role of Toru Iwashi will be Kai after World, probably. Yeah. Which, by the way...
What is Kai going to do? Not much. Kai's going to take it easy that night.
Kai, we have your Paradox t-shirt just sitting over there next to Hulk and Yamato. It's time. Y'all can go back together. We're fine now.
Brother, thank you. Hey, you take it easy tonight. It's Kobe World, Kai. You relax.
Yeah. Oh, do you need to get on the train from Yokohama? Do you actually?
Hey, brother, we'll send the check to you. You don't even need to come pick it up.
That's what we call the Arakan treatment.
Do you think? Well, I guess Arakan could show up at World. I would love to see Arakan back at World.
Yeah. What's Arakan up to right now?
I don't know.
I feel
I'd love to see him.
I feel like it's been a while since I've seen Kenichiro Arai, and I'm not even having my autocomplete finish for him at this point.
No, but I mean, you look at these cards. These cards are full. Like, they don't need the Arakans. They don't need the Kinesas. They don't need the Gammas to fill out these cards. Like, you watch these Korokan shows in particular. It's like, this is a loaded lineup again.
Yeah, I mean, Gigi Horiguchi was not on these shows this week.
Sorry, I just hit my microphone with my drink. Yes, no Genki. I don't know the last time. I guess Genki was in Korokan somewhat recently. But yeah, I mean, when Genki's not on a show, I don't notice. It's more noticeable when Genki's on a show that makes tape.
That's fair. Just to finish the bit, I'm going to run real quickly through the last three Kenichiro Arai matches. He did the Omega Bash with Yuji Hino, him and Hoshitango, and Shogun Okamoto versus Ayame Sasamura, Kaiji Tomato, and Takahiro Katori. That's fine. Let me tell you about what he did in Tenryu Project the 2 months before that. Don Fuji and Kenichiro Arai versus Quiet Storm and The Bodyguard in Osaka. That's a match I'm interested in. Even more so,
awesome in a weird way.
Even more so, here's what happened at the Tenryu Project 15th anniversary. Kenichiro Arai basically is working Tenryu, and like, he's basically not working anything else. But it's Masaki Mochizuki and Don Fuji versus Kenichiro Arai and Brother Yoshi.
I knew that match happened. I haven't seen that match. I knew that match happened. I would like to watch that match.
Yeah. I mean, that tells you what Kenichiro Arai is up to. Not a whole lot. I wonder if he has July 13th circled like we do. Okay. So anything you wanted to touch on before we go? Before I forget, Toru Washi had his last full-time Dragon Gate matches this week, where he remained a net positive.
Net positive Awashi. Love the guy. More power to him. Write this down for next week, Mike. Opening topic. I'm serious. Write this down. I don't want to forget it.
I have my pen out right now. What is it?
Opening topic for next week. Tokyo Garentai. I'm going to leave it at that. I want to talk about it. I've got thoughts on it. I don't have time, though. I am recording this show in my work studio. I borrowed it from a coworker who is currently, I can see through the glass in another room, is currently watching NXT, and I'm trying to leave before he asks me about it. So I have to go. I apologize, everybody. Tokyo Garentai on the schedule next week, opening topic.
Yep, that's our opening topic next week. You can follow us on social media on Blue Sky and Twitter at Open Voice Gate. Case is at _ in your case on Twitter. I'm at Fujiheya there as well. The best place to join the conversations, the Voices of Wrestling Discord. There's the Dragon Gate channel where we talk about the shows often in real time, but also the Open the Voice Gate channel where we post show notes. And whenever there is a new episode of those days, we make sure that you all find out about it there first as well. But that's going to do it this week. Next week, we're talking about Tokyo Garentai, and that's all I know. Have a good rest of your week, everyone.
Hello there, everybody. It's me, Gary Kidney, the co-host of You've Got to Be Kidding Me on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
And I am Liam Jones, my full name, and I'm also a part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network as a co-host for You've Got to Be Kidding Me.
We are a TNA history podcast that covers TNA 1 month at a time. We cover all the drama, all the matches, all the Vince Russo nonsense you could ever want in your life.
Have you heard of TNA? I bet you have, but would it be funnier if two people made jokes over it the whole time? Probably.
So if that sounds like fun to you, check it out on this very Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network, and Liam will do bits and whatnot.
Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it, it's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line, now 20% lower. Family plans, also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone. All with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.